So it is my great pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea our very good friend, Jampa Dorje, a.k.a. Richard Lee Denner. He is has been a poet for lo these many decades, a publisher as well, a Tibetan-style Buddhist practitioner. He was telling us intimating at the existence of some good gossip earlier. I don't know if he'll get into that tonight. We'll see. Certainly, we won't force him to do that. But it's always enjoyable to hear what Jampa has to say. So please join me in welcoming Jampa Dorje to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
So gossip.
I just realized I need to put your tea on the table.
Well, some of you are old friends and some of you are people new. I lived in this area, Sebastopol, Santa Rosa, for 10 years. My parents retired from the Berkeley, Oakland Bay Area in 1965. And they both lived to a ripe old age of 98 and 99. My father was born in 1900, so he saw a century, and my mother as well, into the 21st century. I had begun to study the Tibetan Buddhism in terms of serious practice about 1989. I met a woman named Soltram Alioni in Washington, and she's well known as what's known as Chud, which is a practice of a shamanistic practice, a practice generally traditionally performed in graveyards. It's used to the word Chud means to cut through, and so it was a subject that interested me from early readings of Alexandra David Neal in her books Magic and Mystery of Tibet. But it was sort of difficult to find anybody that really knew much more about it than just what I could read in her sketch. But with the coming of Tibetan masters from into the United States, there began to be people that did practice Chud. So I went and took a liking to her presence and the practice itself. But she had a vision of finding some land somewhere in the United States in which to do long retreat, a traditional Tibetan retreat, lasts 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, tied to the lunar calendar. And in that practice, one does a cycle of practices. It's not just one long practice. It's many practices contained within a group of practices. And it's a sort of formidable enterprise to take that on. Most people can't get off the grid long enough to do a weekend practice, let alone 3 years. But at the time, it was part of her vision to establish some land that was open, that had great open skies, such as are in Colorado, which is where she found a 1,000-acre plot of land. And through her resources and her connections over a period how long is that now? 20-some years, 25 years. She's managed to create a temple and housing for a community of practitioners. And many lamas of the Tibetan tradition, especially the Nyingma tradition, which is the old school, have come to Taramandala to teach. And I, at the time, owned a bookstore in Ellensburg, Washington. That's Central Washington. There's a small university there, Central Washington University. I had moved there in the 70s to manage a cattle ranch, an 800-acre ranch with 300 head of cows and calves. I had just returned from Alaska after spending many years wandering through different parts of Alaska. I went to school at Fairbanks, and I stayed in the woods doing what I call a Henry David Thoreau type retreat. And so I was looking for a new adventure. Ellensburg offered an opportunity, and I started a small bookstore. After 20 years of running the bookstore, and it was kind of through the 80s, there was the New Age movement. We've have somewhat gone beyond that, although many bookstores such as this are rarer than they once were. To the benefit of the community that you're still in existence. And so I would go to Terramandla in the summers and do practices and work on the land. I mean, at that time we were camping out and cooking on Coleman stoves. As things moved along, we got some refrigeration and some gas stoves and with tarps over them, and then we finally built a community building where we actually have a full kitchen. And then as of 5 years ago, we have a three-story temple and a residence hall and several cabins and many yurts. And so now it has become an international retreat center. At the time when my parents died, or my father died first, and then my mother lived on to be 98. When she passed away, I had the opportunity to go to Colorado and begin a long retreat under the direction of a Tibetan Lama, the sixth Golchen Toku, which is a status that he has. He had moved from Montana to Santa Fe, which was nearby Terramandla, and was able to direct this retreat because it requires interaction with an established lama to be able to have the transmissions necessary to perform the rituals and to gain the knowledge of how to actually do the practices. He would set up periods of teaching every 6 months during the better season, and then in the winter we would stay in isolation for 6 months to 7 months. There's many details about that. Perhaps you're curious, and I could answer some questions. But I'm trying to give some background to some of what I propose to read that would reflect my experiences while in retreat as a wilderness experience. Are we on the same page now?
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay, so. Lately I've been studying Western philosophy since I returned from retreat, that was 4 years ago, because I found certain themes in the practices that I was doing and in the metaphysics of the Nyingma Mahamudra school, of which seemed to suggest to me certain aspects of philosophy that we have in the West. Especially 18th century German philosophy and an American transcendentalism. Also, the feelings that I had from my earlier retreat in the woods when I lived in Alaska for 2 years in a wilderness cabin and hunted and fished for sustenance with my wife and child as companions, there was an overlap also in terms of the nature experience, which the transcendentalists feel was a benefit to people who become so engrossed in their materialistic pursuits that they kind of lose sight of what they are as humans. And Thoreau then deliberately, and the term deliberately is important because he went to deliberate deliberately, which was a rarity for anyone to do that sort of thing in the West, to go off alone like that. He wasn't a practitioner in the sense that the Buddhists would call practice, but he was a nature lover, a botanist, a surveyor, and he did come and go. It wasn't a strict retreat, but you had to feel that he had managed to find sustenance, a sort of spiritual sustenance, if I can use the term, from his life meandering through the woods and sort of enjoying nature for itself. And perhaps through his reflections came more in tune with who he was as a human, and it the examined life. And then he was able to more or less go back to the world of getting and spending and continue. On the other hand, when I went into retreat, the cauldron, I would call it, that I was put in a sense, deconstructed my personality in such a way that when I came out after 4 years of those studies and practices, I came out right at a time when there had been the recession, and there was Facebook, and there were iPhones, and the general tenure of reality was quite warped from within that very short period of time. It may have, for many people, may have seemed like there was a little continuity there, but for me there was a break. And the first thing that happened was I got in my truck and tried to drive to Santa Fe, and I totaled my truck. And then I caught some kind of virus, which by being isolated for 4 years, I was susceptible to. And then there were a number of events that made me begin to doubt the nature of reality, that I was sort of like in a liminous zone where I wasn't sure that I was going to survive. And so I went back into retreat for another year, but not to practice Buddhism. I went to read, sort of binge read some of the great Western classics like The War and Peace, which is on my bucket list, and Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, and Dostoevsky, and a few of these heavy tomes of literature, trying to see what was going on in the West and in the East at the same time, to kind of come to terms with sort of my sort of somewhat fragmented sense of reality. The Lama that I was studying with, Tokusanak, he's a unique Lama. He had spent 9 years in a Chinese prison, so he's kind of a tough Lama. We call him a kind of gangster Lama. His approach is not the soft, you know. He just kind of kicked me out of a retreat. Said, "You just stay in there, you'll become a cave bug." And so I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. I went back to Santa Fe and lived with another Lama who was a temple painter, and we began doing some paintings for the Taramandala Temple. And I enjoyed that, but it was still not sure exactly. I was learning a lot about what it's like to live with Tibetan Buddhists that practice all the time, as against Western practitioners that practice at given times, at set mm-hmm. times. Mm-hmm. With Lama Gurme, his name was Gurme Rinpoche, and his wife and child, there was sort of no separation. He would have certain times they practiced, but he might practice at any time. And also it seemed like everything that they did was somehow connected to their religion. And so I got much more, having never traveled to Tibet, I got much more of a sense of the homogeneity or the kind of integration of practice and daily life. But I still felt sort of out of place. And so I returned to Ellensburg, which I had set off from earlier to be with family and friends, and decided to take classes at the university in philosophy, which is cheap. For $15 you take a class, and you don't even have to do the work. Listen. But being a writer, I felt that I should apply myself, and perhaps I could take some of the writings that I had written during that year-long retreat, which was more of a literary retreat. I not only read, but I also started to write, I guess, an autobiography. But I wasn't sure I could write it as Jampa Dorje, So I created a persona named Bouvard Pécochet, who was a kind of a French philosopher in the sort of tradition of the post-structuralists, you know, Foucault and Diderot and these guys, Giles Deleuze, to take over my project and allow him to interview me occasionally, but basically to write it from the third person so that I could tell closer to the truth and get to areas that were kind of difficult to get to in the first person. I don't know if this makes sense, but it was a gimmick anyway that helped me. So some of the writings that I did shift from the first person to the third person only because of that process. Also, in these classes, the writings, there were essays to write, and so since I have this method of making small little chapbooks, I've been doing this for, since the 60s, they're just, it's under the imprint of DePress, and they're, these formats sort of like are reminiscent of the City Lights style, only they're short. I thought I could turn in a chapbook for term paper for an essay, which impressed the teacher because mostly the students. So I started to admonish the students that they should learn to write the great American term paper. I think David Foster Wallace wrote the great American novel, so I figured all that was left was the great American term paper. So let me read one. This one's called A Meditation on Higher Freedoms. I think I smoked a little pot with that, so that's why they're higher freedoms, lower freedoms. So between University Avenue and East 7th Street, and between Sampson and Walnut in Ellensburg, there's some wild nature. Not exactly wilderness, but a patch of land left alone and gone to seed. The trail is about 70 paces along the edge of a creek. A piece of cardboard in the bushes gives me a dry place to sit on the dewy grasses. I've brought food from Safeway's deli, and my plan is to step off the grid for an hour and find solitude. My first urge is to start naming the plants and animals, even put in the Latin, Pseudosuga manzozizi and so forth, but to get in contact with nature, the nature of mind within and the nature of reality, naming things isn't going to get me there. I have to go beyond the tree and the forest to where there is no perceiver or perceived, just for an inconceivably wondrous moment. A few lines of Wordsworth's comes to mind. The world is too much with us. The world is too much with us, getting and spending. We lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. And these meters lead me to appreciate the gap that exists between people living in society and what it's like to live alone in the woods. I'm making a concerted effort to step out of my city life mindset and be still. Reeser Creek, emerging from under the pavement, makes a couple of dramatic bends through this part of town. By slightly turning my head, I can see a landscape without any man-made objects. There's a mix of birch saplings and older, gnarly cottonwoods on the north shore, a few young pines, maybe a subspecies of Pinus ponderosa to the south, one large standing tree, an evergreen, standing there before this area was a park, maybe standing in front of a farmhouse with the trail being here when the Pashampawampums lived here. Anyway, this tree gives off an old vibe. Sitting on my sheet of cardboard, I make a soak offering, a Tibetan tantric feast where one is blessed in a sea of senses, sight, sound, touch, taste, all tastes as one taste. The crunch of coleslaw, the saltiness of ham, and the sweetness of berry pie, the rush of the water, the verdure of the foliage, the limpid blue sky. A male mallard duck flies through, my eyes follow its path, the hunter in me taking aim, and the drone of construction sounds in the background now becomes that of furiously flapping wings. Deep memory follows a beaten path, and my feet lead the way. I'm up for an adventure. I have on a couple of sweaters to shield me from the gusts of frigid air passing through the trees. The density of the undergrowth increases, and the bushes snag my clothes. And then I come upon a renegade shrine to a dead teenager, a memorial tree covered with friendship ornaments, a tree with a plaque that says, "Wish you were here." And I think, lucky to be here now. But then how to cross the creek in the marsh? And as I approach an upended root structure of one of the trees that bridge the creek, a tangle of wings powerfully rising from the weeds disturbs the air. I'm prepared for another mallard, but a great blue heron, yikes, escaping out of the entanglement of nature, and I escape by crossing a log and set foot on concrete, still trembling from the excitement of my encounters. Across from me is Vindman's Bakery, and I'm beginning to sense freshly baked croissants, and voila, I've returned to the predictability of the grid. So part of the challenge of the class was to discover an experience in nature, whether it was out in difficult terrain or just on the street. This particular spot had its little bit of magic because it was just enough to be able to enter into a natural environment, but with the city completely surrounding it. But the class moved on into other areas, such as the history of the philosophers of nature in American tradition, Emerson, in his essay Nature, who was one of the first to admonish his fellow citizens to experience nature, in somewhat of a reaction to, at that time, the Unitarian Church's movement towards logical positivism, if this is not quite maybe the best term, but the sense that Unitarians were beginning to look at the empirical sciences as in positivist philosophy, in which only experience and logic can bring us to knowledge, and we're slipping away from more of the mystical a priori traditions. And so there was a little bit of interplay between these philosophers that persists to where I think most of us, I mean, I go to a Unitarian church, we're basically atheists, a few deists. So I thought I'd write to Thoreau and kind of bring him up to date, you know. Salutations from my outpost, Thoreau, in the Pacific Northwest. I can imagine you snug in your cabin at Walden Pond. I know you've only received one or two letters in your life that you considered worth the postage, and I'm not sure that this one will reach up to the standard that you've set, but I feel compelled to fill you in on a few developments of a philosophical nature that is dear to your heart. I've been taking classes at Central Washington University, which is located in the city, really a small town, of Ellensburg. My present focus is the philosophy of wilderness as taught by Michael Gerger. He's a spirited individual and rigorous in his analyses of our contemporary dilemma relating to the conflicting demands upon the tracts of wilderness bequeathed to us through congressional bills and the whims of presidents since your time. And in many ways, your experiment of going to the woods to live and your many writings on your experiences have been an inspiration to generations of naturalists and outdoor enthusiasts of all ilk. What seemed in your time like an infinite expanse of land with a cornucopia of resources is becoming a limited commodity. I use the word commodity because so many of our countrymen consider the wilderness only as a material resource, something without value unless it can be exploited for financial gain. Any ethical appraisal or concept of aesthetic nourishment the wilderness might offer is considered to be a byproduct reserved for a privileged few. This is an interesting aspect of this argument as it opens, I think, in terms of how we look at wilderness and who is it for, and whether we should just use it for land development for realtors and to draw from the resources, especially now, like the forests are all on fire, we should have cut them down. I mean, the arguments come forth as to, you know, exactly what the wilderness is and what we're looking for in wilderness and how we can share wilderness and if there even is wilderness. What seemed in your time is not the time, or his time is not what's going on in this time. The debate on how to manage the federal parks we call our national treasures, an idea, not even a twinkle in his eye when he was living in his cabin, have been continually raging since Theodore Roosevelt, our 26th president, made conservation a top priority by establishing an array of national parks, forests, and monuments intended to preserve the nation's national resources. The realization came to us that our scenic wonders should be protected, and steady progress has been made by environmentally conscious individuals to ensure that some of this heritage will be protected for future generations. After you so poignantly revealed in Walden, or Life in the Woods, how nature opposes human society, others discovered that they too could find solace and renewal from the deadening existence of social intercourse. Dr. Gerger has had, as reads, selections from your works, the works of your dear friend Ralph Waldo Emerson, as well as from the works of John Muir, Sigmund Olson, Howard Zanheiser, and Edward Albee. While Emerson is a true philosopher, Muir is a true outdoorsman and an adventurer who explores the wild western United States and writes profoundly about the destruction of the forests and the beauty of untrammeled wilderness. Check out his Atlantic Monthly articles around 1880. He railed against the havoc caused by logging and mining in order to get Congress to establish protections and create some kind of management of our resources instead of just wasting them. He's forthcoming about his connection to God in the setting of the great outdoors, and he focuses on beauty and the aesthetic value of his nature experiences. In 1903, Roosevelt camped with John Muir in Yosemite Valley in California, and Muir convinced Roosevelt to establish a national park while the valley was still pristine. Today, it's overrun by tourists, but it's still a sublime vista. Perhaps we should build a dam. We have one in the smaller Yosemite, right? Feeds us water, right?
Ketchy.
Mm-hmm. Come west, Thoreau, and see it before we build another dam, right? I'm going to leave that. I'm going to jump over a few of these because I want to ask some questions. So Zanheiser, maybe we haven't heard of. I mean, has anyone heard of Zanheiser? He's a very important, not necessarily an outdoorsman. He's a bird of a different plumage, I say. Not much of an outdoorsman. He's more of a missionary on a quest to secure wilderness for future generations. He believes, quote, wilderness is something to which everyone is entitled, including those that are not born, unquote. The battle to retain some semblance of wilderness has become desperate since you stood in the clearing near your cabin and listened to the sounds of frogs along the banks of Walden Pond. Although Zanheiser is not one to rough it, he concurs with your view that the mass of men live lives of quiet desperation. But he doesn't go so far as to say that unconscious despair is concealed even under what are called the games and amusements of mankind, because he feels that in these times we need recreation like camping and sports in the wilderness as well as mystical experiences. He too is against development in the sense of exploiting the wilderness for commercial profit, and he accomplished a monumental task by writing and husbanding through Congress what is now called the Wilderness Act. If you can imagine doing something like that today, you know. So the key to Zanheiser's idea was that a wilderness in contrast to those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. Now, I'm not sure there is such a place left, but it's a nice idea. As flying over, I noticed there still are tracks that seem like wilderness, but there are little bike trails along the ridges of them all. So this untrammeled quality is still kind of controversial, if you can have that. This is a long essay, so that's to bring it into context of the meditations of wilderness philosophers living in the many ways that we use wilderness. I mean, we go out for hunting and fishing. I made a little story. It's my version of Field and Stream. I only call it Stream and Field. This year's subscription you can get for 89 cents a piece. And they have my little hunting stories in them when I lived in the cabin. Let's just begin. Jampa went, this is a Bouvard story. So Jampa went to Alaska in hopes of being taken on board of a trawler and fishing for salmon. Instead, after a brief stint as a logger, he was hired to handle fish, freezing and breaking them out of freezers at Ketchikan cold storage. The fishing boats would unload their catch, and Jampa and a crew of workers would sort the fish, halibut or salmon, into sizes and species categories. Salmon separated by species, Chinook, Chum, Coho, Pink or King, and Sockeye. Halibut are separated by weight. Small halibut are called chicken halibut, and over 100 pounds are called whales. Between the sizes of halibut are designed 10-20s, 20-40s, 40-60s, 60-80s, and they are put in carts. Once the head has been hacked off, and in the case of salmon, the eggs have been removed and quickly pushed into freezing rooms and laid on shelves. And these freezing rooms reach temperatures of 40 degrees below zero during the night, and in the next morning the crew pry the fish loose from the shelves with long iron bars, and again they put them into carts, taking the carts on elevators to storage rooms where the temperature is maintained near 10 degrees above zero. A wall is created by interlocking the halibut head to tail, and as the wall rises, the enclosed area is filled with frozen fish. The crew enjoy themselves by sliding the frozen carcasses across the rising pool until it reaches the roof beams. And again, they enjoy the waterfall of fish when the wall is breached and the fish tumble to the floor to have their fins trimmed. The trimming part was not Jampa's favorite job. He preferred the excitement of rapidly firing a bin of salmon to his partner on a high shelf to be stacked in neat pyramids, or in maneuvering a whale halibut from a cart by inserting one gloved hand into the gullet and grasping a bone while the tail was cradled in his other arm, and with a quick lift, pivot, and squat movement, deftly sliding the heavy fish onto a bottom shelf. The trimming of the fins off halibut meant standing in one place for a long period of time. Of course, if you run out of fish to trim, you could always go to the top floor and follow the narrow catwalk and descend into the cavern to make ice. Here, water is frozen in metal containers, and the blocks are stacked with the aid of a conveyor belt 2 stories deep. Comes fishing season, the blocks of ice will be crushed and poured into the holds of ships to keep their catches fresh. After 2 seasons of cold storage, Jampa learned that being cold is a relative concept. And this is important because one of the later, or to me it's important, because one of the practices that I had to learn or was taught in retreat was how to dry sheets that have been dipped into cold water and wrapped around you at sub-zero temperatures. And some of the techniques that were taught were very similar to the techniques that were taught to me by an old Filipino man. Jampa learned to control his cold of fear of cold. He would take breaks from his work to go out to the freezer to sharpen his knife. But the more experienced workers knew what he was doing. He worked with an old Filipino man, and Jampa asked him how he maintained the steady pace. He was told not to let his mind think about the cold and to focus on trimming fish. It's esoteric knowledge. Be going, where are we time-wise? Maybe a little more?
Yep. Huh? We're, the time is now 8:13.
Is everyone still interested in any of this?
Yeah.
Good, all right. So maybe I read from Solitude and Beyond, which is one of the is this a Bouvard? Yeah, Bouvard. Because these themes, they come and go. Here's Emerson criticizing Thoreau. Instead of engineering for all America, Emerson criticized Thoreau, quote, instead of engineering for all America, he was the captain of a Huckleberry party. Jampa would like to join this party. Thoreau writes in his essay, Walking, every sunset which I witness inspires me to go to the west as distant and as fair as that into which the sun goes down. Jampa replies, Thoreau would envy me. I live in the Rockies, the west of his future. It's a pretty walk from Walden Pond. In the east, sacred wisdom that I can also find looking far to the west and entering my lama's mind stream. Like the 19th century naturalist whose studies seemed to his contemporaries to be mere idleness, the reasons for wanting to be a hermit in the 21st century may appear to be the lifestyle of a slacker. But as the 14th century master of meditation, Longchenpa, admonishes, avoid places of division, diversion, and distraction. Remain in solitude to deepen your meditation. For Thoreau, the fruit of his meditations and observations was to come into harmony with nature while retaining the advantages of the arts and sciences. For Jampa, the fruit of his path is the view that he has never in actuality been separate from his original state. Here's a poem of Jampa's. Long periods in luminous peak without a reference point. Life goes on in the world. An airplane leaves a contrail headed west. At night, a distant light, a car moving, then gone around the bend. I do some shadow dancing and laugh. Maybe I've gone around the bend. Jampa's not lonely. Although when he is with people, he enjoys their company and is convivial. He accepts that aloneness is the human condition. He accepts that aloneness is the human condition. And on a deeper level, he's found the self who is lonely, nay, who is alone, is a phenome created by consciousness and a self-liberated vidyahara to which he aspires, which is a knowledge holder of the symbols of the supreme secret teachings. There is no way you can be alone if you have attained the youthful vase body that is emptiness. So Jampa is alone because the path he follows to become a Vidyahara is well blazed, and he feels the presence of the great masters to whom he often appeals for support. A little poem. I follow the masters of meditation. Their bony fingers say, up here, we're up here. Luckily, I have my flashlight. Sometimes I go off track. In retreat at Luminous Peak, Jampa's boundaries are set. He's ritualistically sealed in. little poem. My retreat boundary extends 10 feet beyond my deck. I'm overwhelmed by the infinite and all that I'll never see here. There are 2 days of the week when he walks up the gravel road to his food box, on Tuesdays before noon to deliver his food list, and on Thursdays at 1 to pick up his supplies. It's not a long walk, but Jampa turns it into a promenade. On some occasions and on other days, he does a walking meditation, taking trouble-free steps, going without arriving, in the style practiced by Thich Nhat Hanh. On some of these rare outings, Jampa stops by a tall, first-growth ponderosa pine with a hollow core, the kind of tree a shaman might enter into another realm. Little poem. That tree on the path, knurled with withered limbs, I give it a hug. I'm old and knurly with a withered limb, too. Jampa claims he asked the tree its name and was told to call it TM. And Jampa asked if TM was its first name or its last name, and the tree replied that TM represented its location, since a tree has no need of a self. TM asked Jampa if he was at all lonely in retreat, and Jampa said, actually, it gets crowded living in tight quarters with 100 wrathful and peaceful deities. So you can see there's a good-natured rapport going on, but that's as far as it goes. Embracing the tree is a basic Qigong exercise, but then Jampa creates imaginary dialogues with a pine tree is an indication that he sometimes misses human contact, and this usually occurs when his practice falters and he has doubts about his path. A little poem. A morning of mantra muddle, mudra mangle, and fuzzy yidam, I put paid to this condition of frustration and confusion. So when there's this kind of an eruption, Jampa remembers his lama's pith instruction. When your practice gets difficult, do more practice. And he does. Here's a little story by Jampa. It's called The Yogi and the Lizard. I'm going to conclude with this. A lot of creatures hereabouts are young and skitterish, but one old lizard pulls up and we palaver. He or she gets a bit of dharma from me, and I get a bit of lizard wisdom from him, the usual from me. Rare is one's luck to find the holy dharma. All things are impermanent. Consider this in practice so you will be free of regret at the time of death. And from him, rare is the opportunity to rest in the sun. In a solitary place, safe from predators and busybodies, and close to a hidey hole. While I rest, I visualize myself as a winged dragon, and I ascend into the sky, soar once around a Kajabi peak and cross Hidden Valley to Chimney Rock, and then back, and I settle on my rock again in a state beyond image and chill out. Some of Jampa's journey. And may it go on. Anybody have some questions about anything I've talked about? Or any comments? Yeah.
How did your sense of what you are change from the beginning of your retreat to this point in time?
Well, of course, one goes into these retreats expecting you're going to attain enlightenment, you know, whatever this means. It's a goal, the ultimate realization of the nature of self and the nature of reality. And it's taught in a certain way, so that basically, through practices, one is undermining that sense of a integrated self. It's hard to get rid of the person, but the sense of the self as a integrated single thing, becomes undermined through through being exhausted by challenging yourself over and over again. To some extent, I think the my alternative was to create alternative personalities rather than to get rid of the self, was to have more of them. And some of it, of that idea, stemmed out of the tantric practices of what are called the five Buddha families, of the nature of that's part of a mandala, and that each of the different deities, that whether it's the male deity or a female deity, in my case, that we were female deities, under Machiglatram was the central figure. And so each of those, in the tantric practice, one identifies with each of them separately and looks for their wisdom as well as their weaknesses. And so one looks at one's own strengths and weaknesses through that and understands that there are phases or moods or aspects of oneself that relate, parallel that. So that whether, you know, whether when one speaks of the I, when I say I'm sitting here, I'm not denying that there's something sitting here.
So,
but I don't know what that I really is. I mean, I observe it. And so I can play with whether it's got a name or whether it has parameters. And so that increased dramatically. Because previous to that, I was this a kind of a Berkeley street poet when I was younger, and then I had quite a literary career as a sort of as a poet. And the solidification of that Richard Lee Denner identity was something that now seems very far away. When it comes, you know, is that enough?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Right up the alley that I was calling out from.
Yeah, okay.
And then, so it sounds like you feel as if you're more free to choose how you want to identify yourself.
Yeah.
It's more fluid.
Obviously, when you've I used Jampa Dorje because that was my refuge name, but I must have had five or six secret names that have been given me at different levels of at different initiations.
Yeah.
And I drop into those modes of self when I'm doing one thing or another in a ritualistic way. I don't need to do that when I'm kind of just on the street, so I still. But I find that it's sort of like, it's a little complicated because, like, I was introduced as Richard Denner, a.k.a. Jampa Dorje, and so I often have to do that so that, because I'm sort of known in different worlds. In Taramandala, I've been Jampa Dorje for so long, and I'm recognized as a minor lama, and so therefore I have a role as Lama of Jampa.
Uh-huh.
If I go to my family, I'm known as Dick.
Uh-huh.
Or Rich, which hardly anyone would call me, if they knew me, because I formally took the name Richard. So when I'm in certain contexts, then when I moved back to Ellensburg, people wanted to know what to call me, and so I sometimes introduce myself as Jampa if I feel it's a new person and they're seeing me as the I'm known as the farming town monk. They actually did a whole newspaper spread on my life and put it on the front page. So there's a lot of people that accept me as sort of a local eccentric and the monk. And so I perpetuate that self. But I have old people when I came there as a cowboy that know me as Dick. Right? Dead-eyed Dick. So there's those times. So, and then then some of them want to say, well, what's your real name? And I say, whatever it is that you come up with, right? So, in that way, that helps to break away from that. I'm nobody. I'm anyone. I'm many selves. And there's so I feel more spontaneous with that sense that I don't know where I'm going next. Who else? Yes.
Tell me about the cowboy.
Well, it's a little funny that I grew up in Oakland Hills when I was in high school. I went to Oakland High. And that's it was a horsey zone. They had stables up there. I suspect some of them are still there. And so my dad was he worked for State Farm when it was, the home office was in Berkeley. Now it's in Santa Rosa someplace, or maybe it's Ron Hurt Park. And so he had enough money to sort of be a gentleman rancher. So we had a cattle ranch up in Willits, 1,200 acres, a kind of mountain ranch. And then we had another ranch over in Red Bluff, over toward where the Ishii used to live in that zone, the last Indians. And so I had a little bit of, like, I showed horses, and I did a little rodeoing, and I worked on working ranches. Kind of not like that we're totally self-supporting, but we worked cattle. We branded and did that. So when I moved back from Alaska, I moved to Seattle, and I was working in a newspaper, and I saw an ad to work for a cattle ranch in Ellensburg. And Ellensburg's famous for its rodeo. It's got a big rodeo like Pendleton and Calgary. It's on the big circuit. We have what's called the Extreme Bowls, where all the bull riders from the country do their final ride in Ellensburg. So it's a scene, and there's lots of, they're not big ranches, they're mostly farms, or ranches that are maybe 400 acres, and they'll raise some alfalfa hay, and they'll have some cattle. This ranch that I hired on to had 800 acres, but 600 of that was out in the sagebrush. Ellensburg has Kittitas Valley is irrigated from the old land reclamation projects of the 30s when they put in the canals and they irrigated that valley. So because my dad had these ranches, I had some familiarity with it. Plus, he always had trouble keeping a steady hand on the ranch. And the gentleman that owned the ranch was having that problem. And so I really intuited what he needed and could fulfill that role. And I did it for a couple of years. It gave me a house, and I could raise a hog or a steer for personal use, for to butcher. And all I had to do is maintain and keep count on those calves. And then there was irrigation land. So we had 160 acres of irrigated land. So you had to push water, they call it, around, and then you move cattle from field to field. So in a way, it's sort of semi-farm, not so much your Texas, a wide-range ranch,
right.
Kind of a farm.
Did you get pumps for the irrigation?
No, there's a canal that runs completely around the valley, we were at the canal, so there was the main ditch, and then you take a branch out of that, and then the fields are corrugated, and you learn to kick cow pies out of the corrugation and try to move the water around. Make it go uphill. That's you're a master if you can make the water go uphill. But you can sometimes get the gravity flow to actually you learn to kind of push it up. And then the grass grows. Like, we had a really good season this year. We raised, the valley raises Timothy, which is racehorse feed, and it's a really high protein hay. So that's a kind of, again, I was also, like, kind of in that was the early, mid-70s, and counterculture was just sort of reaching that area, so I had really long hair. And they were very skeptical about long-haired cowboys, but I had such a background in horsemanship that they couldn't touch me.
Did you wear a cowboy hat?
Oh yeah, the whole thing. Oh. Yeah, chap. I had shotguns. It was a zip-up, and we'd ride out in the sagebrush, and yeah, I did the thing. And we still branded. We roped and did all that stuff. A lot of it. I think a lot of people, like this guy that owned the ranch, Gil Hankins, for him it was like my dad. He just something to do on the weekend to bring his girlfriend over and show off. And so I had to keep his horses tuned up so that they were right. He could ride them because they'd get kind of spicy if you left them too long. So it was a good job. Go ahead.
Was your family with you?
Well, I have a wife, and I've had four wives. This was my second wife. So I had
And children?
I had, yeah, my son. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so she the ranch was too far out of town, so she took a job in town at a lawyer. She was a receptor, you know, kind of a paralegal or something. She had some job. Our marriage kind of ended right after that. We originally went to Alaska to make some money on a fishing boat, only I wound up in cold storage so I could come back to Berkeley and start a bookstore. But I met Gary Snyder, a famous American poet, who wrote Earth Household, which sort of connected to this. And he said, well, we don't really need another bookstore in Berkeley. Why don't you go someplace where they don't have a Berkeley bookstore and do one there? And so when I went to this little town of Ellensburg, it was an old Victorian town that had been quite a boom town in the 1880s, full of big bars, you know, with brothels above them and and dance halls galore. And so it was in the era of the grunge music in Seattle, when Nirvana and Moral Crux and the Screaming Trees and all those bands were just rising. And so we had some of the greatest music come through that town, with dance halls that were a block long, and it was quite a scene. Some of my older friends and I, we've been reminiscing about that, because that's long past. It's not like that anymore. But it was, yeah, for maybe 15 years, it was sort of like the Bay Area scene without Vietnam War. So it was much more the true kind of love generation feeling of you know, just sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
Do you have time for another question?
Sure. I've got plenty of time.
Anybody wants to
keep me going.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So if I'm not mistaken, Brevard's been around for quite a long time.
Yeah, he was one of the first.
First what?
First persona. I mean, well, there was another kid named Richard Artaud.
Yeah.
Right, Artaud was very early, because we did some collaborations with Artaud. Artaud occurred really out of before we had Facebook and computers in the turn of the in 2000 or around the 1998, when computers had like a gig or two of memory, if we can remember that. And so you always had to get rid of everything so you could go on. And I was in a little chat room, which now would be blogs, I guess. And I needed a name so I could be in this chat room without my own name, because everybody was anonymous. And I happened to have Artaud's Theater of Cruelty, which seemed appropriate, sitting on top of the computer for some reason. So I chose Artaud. And then Brevard, sort of because they're French, and then that era of these sort of insane French philosopher writer types that were quite brilliant. I mean, it's hard to understand that, as insane as they are, and how much gobbledygook they had in their minds, so that they make sense somehow.
So the question is: has Brevard evolved?
Yeah.
Over the years.
Yeah, Brevard. There's a book by Flaubert called Brevard et Pécuchet. That's his last novel that no one reads, everyone hates, because it deals with these two idiots that went out into the country to sort of reinvent everything and fail at everything. And I thought if I took two idiots and put them together, I would have something special. And it sounded like their full name, Brevard et Pécuchet, but it really is two last names. Or two first names. Anyway, so he has evolved, because he has his own writings. He's even courted a woman online for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Spanish writer by the name of Pessoa, Francisco Pessoa.
Yeah.
Some people would know him.
Mm-hmm.
He had 80 personas.
Mm-hmm.
There is a tradition of literary persona that's not unique to me. I mean, little bits of that help. So Brevard originally was a way to get some distance from Jampa. But then he also, and so he sort of originally was kind of his own poet, and man, mm-hmm. but then he became more of the biographer, kind of the Boswell to Dr. Johnson, sort of. And so he often edits. Here he's an editor. So he has, he's become more substantial than many of those. There's Jubal Dolan, who is a, his great-grandfather was one of the last gunfighters in the Old West. Mm. But he died at the age of 19 having sex in a fast car, an automobile. So he did, he only wrote a very thin book of poems. One very, very,
was
very...
Was this one of the personas?
Yeah, it was a persona for a while, but he had to go. And I thought, you know, I had seen that movie, Sex, Death, and Car Crashes by... What's his name? Klockenberg? Huh?
He sounds like a time traveler.
Yeah, well, he was, yeah. So I got rid of him. But he still comes up once in a while. Actually, I started rewriting everything in his name up to a certain point, and then it sort of out. So much of my writing does kind of circle around my own personal life and my own personal experiences, and the only way to kind of sometimes advance that is to rewrite them from another perspective. Because as you can notice, I mean, the themes are always kind of weaving in and out.
Mm-hmm. And that's your question made me think of a different question than I was originally going to ask. Are you, you've written so much in different genres, mm-hmm. and just hearing you talk makes me recall some of your delightful short stories.
Yeah.
And do you think you go back or ever just like go out for fiction and stories?
It isn't. I think it's all fiction.
I mean, some is more than others.
But some is more than others. But I don't know that it isn't all kind of made up. I mean, we're selective, and that's some of the reason I had Bouvard was to try to get sometimes to the sexual truth, which is sometimes hard. Mm-hmm. It was hard when my mother was alive to tell her certain things that she would read, because she would read me. So I was sort of inhibited till after she died. Then I could tell more. But then as I moved on, there were things that then I felt I shouldn't tell. So, I mean, you have to keep some secrets.
Well, that's kind of interesting.
Right?
There's some writers who don't do that, and they get into trouble.
Yeah.
Like Carl Ove Nosgard.
Uh-huh.
He had 14 members of his family write the Oslo paper saying how mad they were at him and disgusted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I didn't want to do that, but I wanted to be able to touch on sensitive areas. But so let's say maybe Forest for the Trees. What is it? I think I put in there. There was that story about the. If anybody read the blurb that Rob put in, the thing about Champa and his Winchester that he ran over. I don't know.
Freshly
blued Winchester. So,
blue means that you put on a barrel of it.
I thought so.
Yeah, so you saw that. So maybe that. This is what. So, I'm trying to think of where this is. It's in the hunting section. Yeah, because I had a gun. Right. Jampa is a hunter. He hunted in California on these cattle ranches, and then when he went to Alaska. He finally gave it up after he'd spent a couple of years. I'm talking in the third person again. After I had been there and had lived off of fish and game, I suddenly started to see that it was kind of the end of it. I mean, I'd kind of gone backwards where it was like sport, and then it became survival, and then it's sort of like, well, you can buy meat in the grocery store. Or give up meat altogether. So there was there's a little bit here where I was. It's happened in the same place. It's interesting because a buck that got away, that Jampa was hunting with his dad on their ranch near Longvale, about 20 miles north of Willits, and they stopped their jeep and fanned out, and Jampa walked back along the dirt road, and the others were below him. Down an incline in a clearing, Jampa saw a little forking horn focused on the approach of the hunters in the bush, and just as he raised his rifle, the buck bolted. Up the incline, he came straight towards Jampa, who turned his rifle sideways to ward off horns, slipped on loose gravel, and fell on his back, and the buck rushed over him, clipping him with the hoof just on the inside of his left thigh. And when the hunters returned, empty-handed and bruised, to the ranch house, Jampa's mom told them that there had been a big buck standing in the orchard eating apples all morning, and that if she had had a gun, she could have pegged it. This news did not brighten the hunter's spirits. These are a series of little stories. Like, here's Jampa and Cherry climbing up Deer Mountain, with Jampa wearing his deer tied his deer skin coat, sneaking along on the first day of hunting through the woods. And when, of course, he started hearing shots, he realized that he was not in the right place, dressed in the right way. So, to get to some of these sexual truths, this happened where this buck almost chopped me. Making out with Toby always left Jampa in a state of frustration. So Toby and Jampa were on the ridge where Jampa had earlier been trampled by the deer. Toby might have said, he's lucky to even have genitals after having been so mauled. The two, alas, there's this aspect of it. Jampa had no real intention to go deer hunting with Toby unless one means it in a poetic way, like in Sir Thomas Wyatt's poem, "He so lists to hunt, I know where his hind," where the Middle English word deer means to stir up, and this can be applied to the effect that Toby had on Jampa. And Toby and Jampa were on the ridge where he had earlier been trampled, and the two of them were nestled in the crotch of a pine tree, kissing, and they had driven to this ridge in a jeep that Jampa had brought his Winchester lever action with a newly blued barrel, his saddle gun. He had taken it from its scabbard and propped it up against the back bumper. Making out with Toby, it always left Jampa in a state of frustration. He tired of her moving his hands away from her breasts and her belt buckle, and after some passionate kisses, he drove her back to the ranch house, and then he realized he'd forgotten his 30-30. He drove back to the ridge, to the place where he had parked, and discovered that he'd run over this phallic symbol of his manhood. "Oh my God, I've run over my gun!" echoed across the valley. I can't help but think this experience deeply scarred Jampa's psyche. See, I couldn't have written that in the first. It had to be told.
Right.
So was that true?
Yeah, actually, yeah. This one's true. Yeah. I mean, the hardest thing was putting in Toby. I could have changed her name, but I didn't. Yeah. But I had been out of touch with her for so long, I figure I'll be dead by the time she reads that, if ever. Another thing is that, in sort of, she seems safe, and so therefore, any things that sometimes would not be appropriate, I could use Toby. Or I could use, so that I could tell stories that were not really true. Mm-hmm. There was just a way around the problem.
And is it a deliberate effect to transpose the Tibetan Buddhist Lama into circumstances?
Anagogical level of the spiritual development of the young street poet into a Tibetan Lama. That's what it's kind of really about. The interesting thing about biography and autobiography and memoir and journal is how you deal with the hero and whether that's you or not. Like in the beginning, the David Copperfield begins, "Am I the hero of my story, or should I give this to someone else?" And it's a question, you know. Rousseau, who wrote Great Confessions, another level of autobiography is confession. There's no greater confessions than maybe Augustine, who really does it. Rousseau wants to create kind of a hero, and many people see this. So how romantic to make it, how many warts to leave, all those things are kind of complicated to figure how to create a story that's you. Is fair.
So to follow with that, do you let the story sort of tell you how to write it?
This was kind of, I don't know.
You know what I mean?
I'm not a really masterful writer in some ways, in a sense of theory. What I did is to do this, it turned out to be 12 illustrated manuscripts that I had to do by hand because I was I was away from a computer.
Thank you.
So I decided I'd write some essays. I'm kind of basically like to write essays. And so I picked 50 subjects alphabetically: animals, business, art, caregiving, and decided each of these subjects I would write something about myself.
All 50?
Yeah, right? All 50. And I could do it in a little short fashion because you try to start writing about yourself when you're a baby, you know, and try to build it all the way through in some kind of coherent fashion and how chronologically. It just seemed impossible. But I could tell about the animals. Like the beginning story would be about I'm walking up a trail and a little chip, I'm talking to a girl, and we're talking about tiglis. And so tiglis are little light spheres that one sees in meditation, part of a Tibetan practice. And this little light sphere suddenly ran under my boot and I crushed it. It was a little chipmunk. And I told her I didn't know what, I thought she should move on because I was what I was going to do. And so I took the chipmunk over and I dug a little hole and I smashed its head with a rock and I put it in this little grave and I put some leaves on it and I did some mantras and I put a cobble on top. And then I followed the trail back up to the Gompa where my Lama was teaching, and the issue of killing came up right away, as it often does in practice, the very subject. And he explained that karmically, I raised my hand and I told him what I'd done, just, you know, as kind of a confession. But also I wanted to know. And he said, well, it really was an accident, the stepping on it, and that I hadn't involved myself in its karma, but by intentionally killing it, I had involved myself with its karma, and that I should have let it burn out its karma. And this immediately made me realize the difference between the East and the West in terms of our view on nature life, and my whole history in terms of hunting animals and working with cattle and so forth. So there was a great Dharma teaching for me in that, based around this story about an animal. And therefore I'd brought in, I could move on to horses and various, you know, so in telling stories I was weaving together personal experience, memoir, Dharma in the telling. Say for caregiving, I was doing the practices of White Tara, which is a mother goddess, and I was taking care of my parents, and I was doing what's called a Nindro, where you do, you have to do many, many practices, among which are 1,800,000 White Tara mantras. But since I was just sitting there with them, I could go to my room and do mantras if they needed me. Then I was there. And in the meantime, I was accomplishing my practices. So that was a way of doing caregiving. And then as my dad progressed and got dementia, I had more challenges because the practices would have to do with patience and loving kindness and metta. And these sorts of teachings that come out of the practices were present for me to do, right? You remember, because my mom was easy. My dad was more of a challenge. But at the same time, I did it because I think my spiritual teachings helped me a great deal and seeing the advantage of doing that. And I could also record some very funny stories about as he got dementia, he would think that there was a conspiracy to change the color of the grass. And so we'd have to go outside. I'd buy into it. I mean, or that there were boxes in the garage full of squirrels. Right?
So we have probably
there probably were. Okay. So I mean everything is fodder, right? I mean, so and some of it's and it's true as much as you can make it true, in telling it. But it's selective because there's only so much one can remember of all the mm-hmm. details. I mean, I could go back and say, well, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, the grass was, you know, now I can remember having to bump down the steps to get there and so forth that I could have added. But I tend, when I write, to go towards the action, you know, just mm-hmm. so my stories tend to be little, kind of little fragments because I don't spend a lot of time ornamenting. Because there's lots of these things that I can just see are kind of interesting little insights into that I remember as much as I remember, and that's going.
Seems like it's all there.
Still holding up.
It's all there.
All right, it's all there. You guys have been a wonderful audience.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's good to
thank
see you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Denver. Yeah,
mm. Okay, so I try to sell these books. This one contains 8 chapbooks, and so they're full of color because they have all the illustrations. And so I need $30 for one of these, but they're $5 a piece this way, and so you know, sort of you get a couple of free ones that way, or this way when you buy the collection.
Those chapbooks are in that paperclip?
Yeah, all of those. There's 8 in that one. Then there's another set here that are various chapbooks from various other writings. Here's a Chitro, which is a true faux City Lights book. Chitro is a practice of death, a death practice, and it deals with Allen Ginsberg's passing because I was talking to him right when he passed. Within a day. So, anyway.
All right. And we also have a donation bowl over there, and we encourage you to contribute to that, which we share with our speakers and retain half to maintain this space for further such events. Thank you all for coming tonight, and do check out the Deep Press Cornucopia we have.
Cornucopia, good word.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Brought you something to
did you?
Show.
Okay.
I'll
show you.
This will be very distant.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I.
Do you remember it?
Together. I do. Was that? Did you buy that when it was up?
You gave it to me.
I gave it to you.
Grayton.
Grayton. Yeah.
So you knew Ginsberg?
Oh yeah, quite well.
Kerouac?
I knew his daughter really well, but not Jack. I just didn't ever connect to.
His self portrait.
No,
I.
Yeah.
All right.
A lot of times, yeah. Some of the Black Mountain poets, like Creeley and Dorn and those, I got to know. Of the Beats, a lot of them, they were gone by the time I was, you know.
Did you ever know a fellow named Wilder Bentley?
No, but was he part of that crowd?
He was a beatnik.
Uh-huh.
He hung out in North Beach and stuff.
Sure.
His dad was a... his dad owned a printing shop in Berkeley on a street near the college and used to print for the college.
Cool.
He was, you know, involved.
A lot of us, you know, like when I was in high school, I hung out but I didn't really get quite what that scene was, you know.
Right.
I mean, we would go over there and wander around. So it wasn't until the mid-60s that I met Ginsberg personally, and then I hosted him up in Alaska, and he came up to Fairbanks.
Well, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Do you want change for the
I don't know. or whatever my opinions were.
So, tomorrow?
Well,
yeah.
I come in, I left my archives with two days, because they only play
for
20
minutes. So I'll be back in town by 12:31.
I just,
Well, I need to call.
Okay.
I just
happened to get it posted.
That's my studio number, which is fine, but this way, no matter where I am.
Okay.
Well,
cool.
Yeah, we were trying to get it.
It makes me realize how much I miss you.
Well, Stuart was always doing it.
Yeah.
Basically, Stuart just said.
Yeah, that was great.
It was okay.
That was hard.
No, it's good, but it was fluid.
It was great.
I think you're telling your own story, but it's how to organize it. See, it is. It's like how to organize yourself in a way around some ideas. Right. Yeah. So I'm getting kind of perfecting that.
It's not mine.
Yeah, all right.
Okay.
Well, we'll get together tomorrow
and
do that.
Some of my stuff. This one is one of my favorite because
I don't know if I'll ever get
that. But having that title, I can say.
No, I don't have to, but.
That's not part of the world.
God originally appeared in John McGorge's Holy Diary. So God becomes a pre-selling.
I just dropped God.
Oh my God. I think you'll like that one because it has a kind of mixture of Buddhism and. So when did I give you that drawing? It was at the
1990s, late 1990s,
yeah.
Or something like that.
Right before,
before
I left.
Yeah, right before you left.
Okay.
You said you were going.
There I was.
Major
I'm gonna grab that thing.
Okay.
Oh shoot!
Oh, I'm.